From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We hope to accomplish all the rights that we deserve, not only as immigrants, but also as people and human beings.
May Day 2007. Hundreds of thousands take to the streets to march for immigrant rights. We'll go to Los Angeles, Chicago, and Detroit. We'll speak with organizers and high school students who walked out of their classrooms to support immigrant rights. And we'll take a look at the rise of the anti-immigrant movement with the nation's Max Blumenthal. And in Washington, D.C., we'll talk to one of two of the protesters involved with some of the largest protests against the American military this year. Not in the U.S., but in Vicenza, a city in northern Italy. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants took to the streets Tuesday in protest in dozens of cities across the country. In Chicago, police said over 150,000 people marched through downtown. In Phoenix, Arizona, organizers put the crowd size at 100,000. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, organizers estimated 60,000 people took part in the city's second annual civil rights march and boycott. Another 10,000 immigrants marched in Detroit and Denver. Los Angeles held two large protests Tuesday. The afternoon protest in L.A. ended when police fired dozens of rubber bullets and tear gas into a peaceful crowd. Families with young children were forced to flee for their safety. Eyewitnesses said police gave little or no warning before firing the rubber bullets. The protests came on the first anniversary of last year's historic May Day immigrant protests. In Los Angeles, organizer Norberto Martinez predicted protests over immigrant rights will continue.
It's not an issue that's going to go away. We're here. We're here to stay. We're not going anywhere. And we do need a solution. We need something that would give us permanent residency. If it doesn't happen with the Bush administration now, it has to happen in the next administration.
We'll have more on the protests in Chicago, Los Angeles, and Detroit after headlines. President Bush has vetoed a $124 billion war spending bill that would have imposed timelines to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq. This sets up a showdown between Congress and the White House over the future of the Iraq war. On Tuesday afternoon, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke at a special ceremony to mark the Iraq bill being sent to the White House.
This legislation respects the wishes of the American people to end the Iraq war. I'm pleased to sign this legislation, which passed both houses of Congress with bipartisan support. I urge the president to sign the Global War on Terror supplemental so that we can refocus on fighting terrorism.
The Democrats sent the bill on the fourth anniversary of the day that President Bush stood under a mission accomplished banner and announced major combat operations had ended in Iraq. Last night, President Bush officially vetoed the legislation.
After forcing most of our troops to withdraw, the bill would dictate the terms on which the remaining commanders and troops could engage the enemy. That means Americans' commanders in the middle of a combat zone would have to take fighting direction from politicians 6,000 miles away in Washington, D.C. This is a prescription for chaos and confusion, and we must not impose it on our troops.
President Bush plans to host congressional leaders from both parties at the White House this afternoon. Criticism of President Bush's veto has come from an unlikely quarter, two retired generals who led troops in Iraq. Major General John Batiste said, quote, "The president vetoed our troops and the American people. His stubborn commitment to a failed strategy in Iraq is incomprehensible." Major General Paul Eaton added, quote, "The president of the United States is holding our soldiers hostage to his ego." In news from Iraq, CNN is reporting Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has created an entity within his government that's apparently being used as a smokescreen to hide an extreme Shiite agenda that's worsening the country's sectarian divide. The office of the commander-in-chief reportedly has the power to overrule other government ministries. In other Iraq news, the Iraqi government has sent a draft oil law to parliament. The law would open up Iraq's vast oil reserves to international oil companies. It would also force Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds to share oil revenue. In media news, Rupert Murdoch is attempting to expand his global media empire. On Tuesday, he made an unsolicited bid to buy Dow Jones and Company, the publisher of the Wall Street Journal, for $5 billion. Murdoch's News Corp is already one of the world's largest media companies. Its holdings include the TV network Fox, the book publisher HarperCollins, the New York Post, MySpace.com, the Weekly Standard, and scores of other media companies. The Bancroft family, which controls the shareholder vote of Dow Jones, said it would oppose Murdoch's deal. In Alabama, federal authorities have revealed they've broken up a militia plot to attack a group of Mexicans living in a small town north of Birmingham. Last week, six members of the Alabama Free Militia were arrested in a series of raids. The Birmingham News reported police uncovered truckloads of explosives and weapons, including 130 grenades, an improvised rocket launcher, and 2,500 rounds of ammunition. The six men appeared in court Tuesday. Despite the violent plot, police did not accuse the men of terrorism. Instead, police charged them with conspiracy to make a firearm, which carries a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and $250,000 fine. The Anti-Defamation League said the weapons seizure was the largest in the South in years. Newly released data from the Justice Department shows the government conducted a record number of secret searches last year. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court issued 2,176 secret warrants in 2006, targeting people inside the United States. The FISA court approved all but one search warrant requested by the Bush administration. The Justice Department, however, did not reveal how many times the FBI secretly sought telephone, internet, and banking records about U.S. citizens and residents without court approval. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports senior Bush administration officials told Congress Tuesday they could not pledge that the administration would continue to seek warrants from a secret court for a domestic wiretapping program, as it agreed to do in January. Senior officials, including the new director of national intelligence, Michael McConnell, said they believe the president still has the authority to once again order the NSA to conduct surveillance inside the country without warrants. The Boston Globe is reporting a new study ordered by the Pentagon has warned the rising cost and dwindling supply of oil will make the U.S. military's ability to fight around the world unsustainable in the long term. The study concludes the military must fundamentally transform their assumptions about energy, including taking immediate steps toward fielding weapons systems and aircraft that run on alternative and renewable fuels. The study found it is imperative that the Pentagon apply new energy technologies that address alternative supply sources and efficient consumption across all aspects of military operations. The military is the largest single energy consumer in the country. In Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez marked May Day by seizing control of the country's remaining privately held oil projects, including what might be the world's richest oil fields, the Orinoco Belt. President Chavez made the announcement before thousands of supporters. He said the move was part of an effort to reclaim the country's resources for the people of Venezuela.
Today's ceremony on May 1st is a historic act. It's going to permit us to intercede with force and weight in the new history that we are building every day. Today, we put an end to a perverse cycle that was opened here more than 10 years ago.
The international oil companies ConocoPhillips, Chevron, ExxonMobil, BP, and Total agreed to transfer of operational control. Venezuela is allowing the private oil companies to remain in the country, but the state oil company has become the majority stakeholder in every project. Cubans marked May Day with a massive march through Revolution Plaza in Havana Tuesday. Hundreds of thousands of people attended. There had been rumors that Fidel Castro would make an appearance, but he did not attend the rally. Castro has not been seen in public since becoming sick in July. In Oaxaca City, Mexico, a group of students marked May Day by taking over a university radio station in order to broadcast messages in support of APO, the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca. Last year, the same radio station, Radio Universidad, served as the nerve center for the popular uprising in Oaxaca. In Nigeria, thousands of people marked May Day by gathering in Lagos and other cities to protest the government for rigging last month's presidential election. This is Joe Oke Adumaken, a leader of the Campaign for Democracy.
Nigerian Labour Congress is having made a celebration that as they are celebrating it, Nigeria is bleeding and we are mourning the death of democracy as a result of our election that was rigged. It was a violent violation of our fundamental human rights to choose who will govern us. So we are giving the government a 2-week ultimatum to cancel the election. And our plan of action starts today, May 1st, with the mourning of the death of democracy in Nigeria.
Odemaken, a leader of the Campaign for Democracy. The fairness of Nigeria's elections have been widely criticized by international election monitors and members of the Nigerian opposition. Last week, the Nigerian Nobel laureate, Wole Soyinka, called for a new vote. Police in Europe have arrested 30 animal rights activists in a series of coordinated raids in Britain, Belgium, and the Netherlands. 700 police officers and staff took part in what's believed to be the largest crackdown ever on animal rights activists in Europe. No charges have been brought against the 15 men and 15 women arrested. One police official accused the activists of waging a campaign of harassment and intimidation against the animal research industry. For years, animal rights activists have waged a successful campaign targeting the British company Huntington Life Sciences because it carries out medical tests on animals. In news from Washington, a high-ranking Interior Department official has resigned after she was accused of pressuring government scientists. Julie McDonald resigned as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks a week before she was scheduled to testify before Congress. Last year, the Union of Concerned Scientists accused McDonald of personally changing scientific reports to prevent endangered species from receiving protection. Survivors of the 1970 massacre at Kent State are calling on officials to investigate what happened on May 4, 1970, when the National Guard shot four students dead at an anti-war rally. On Tuesday, one of the survivors, Alan Canfora, released an audio tape from the day of the shootings. Canfora said, by closely listening, you can hear a National Guard officer issue the command, right here, get set, point, fire. Following the command, the sounds of shots being fired can be heard. The FBI has never determined whether an order to shoot was given. Eight members of the National Guard were acquitted of federal civil rights charges 4 years after the shootings. Canfora said the reel-to-reel audio recording was made by a student on campus. And in sports news, the New York Times is reporting a new academic study on the National Basketball Association has found that white referees called fouls at a greater rate against black players than against white players. The study claims the different rates at which fouls are called is large enough that the probability of a team winning is noticeably affected by the racial composition of the refereeing crew assigned to the game. The NBA has rejected the study's findings. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the second year in a row, May Day featured a massive display of solidarity for immigrant rights in the United States. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets across the country. Marches were held in cities including Los Angeles, Chicago, Detroit, Washington, D.C., Denver, Milwaukee, Phoenix, and New York.
We hope to accomplish all the rights that we deserve, not only as immigrants, but also as people and human beings.
Calls focused on demanding a path to citizenship for undocumented workers, ending raids and deportations that have divided entire families, rejecting anti-immigrant legislation, and thwarting the continued militarization of the U.S.-Mexican border. Although the May Day events went off mostly without incident, one major confrontation took place in Los Angeles. An evening protest was disrupted when police fired rubber bullets and tear gas at thousands gathered in MacArthur Park. LAPD officials said protesters had thrown plastic bottles and other projectiles. Protest organizers dispute the account and are demanding an independent investigation. To help recap and look ahead to what's next, I'm joined now by organizers of the day's two largest protests. On the line from Los Angeles, Angelica Salas. She is executive director of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights in Los Angeles. And from Chicago, we're joined by Jorge Mujica. He is a former journalist and union organizer. He's worked for La Raza, Univision, and Telemundo, and has been involved in union organizing in both the U.S. and Mexico. We're going to begin in Los Angeles with Angelica Salas. Can you explain what happened? Were you at that night protest when the police opened fire with rubber bullets?
Yes, Amy. Good morning. How are you?
It's good to have you with us.
The first thing that I just want to say is that, first and foremost, over 25,000 people gathered in the evening to demand their rights and to demand legalization, a path to citizenship, and to peacefully assemble. To ensure that their families have a better future in this country. And I want to make sure that their efforts are highlighted. It was unfortunate, and we are indignant at the manner in which the police decided to deal with a group of people who were causing disturbances. These were young anarchists who often join our marches, who in every single march in the past, in Los Angeles, is the seventh May Day march, have been isolated away from the crowd. This time, the police showed in from.
Angelica? Well, it looks like we've lost Angelica, but we'll go to Jorge Mujica, and then we'll get Angelica back calling from Los Angeles. Jorge Mujica, can you describe what happened in Chicago?
Yes, Amy, good morning. What happened in Chicago is that we were able somehow to have only one demonstration, every organization united in a single front. And we put up in the streets 150,000, according to the police department. We also obviously believe that it was a lot larger than that, maybe 250,000 people. We didn't have any incidents. I think what happened in Los Angeles is pretty bad. We didn't have it here. And we sent a strong message to Congress. You know, the problem is still here. They didn't solve it last year. They are not solving it this year. And every year that passes, there's going to be another 500,000 undocumented immigrants in the United States.
What are you calling for in Chicago?
In Chicago particularly, we were calling for an end of deportations and raids. 1 week ago, the FBI, in combination with immigration enforcement, sent over 60 federal agents to a shopping mall at 2 p.m. when mothers had just picked up the kids from school and they were doing their shopping. And these federal agents were carrying machine guns and M16s, and they were looking for what is supposed to be a ring of fake ID dealers, you know, sellers of forged IDs. Nevertheless, they handcuffed over 100 people. They made them sit on the floor. They detained 160 people for a couple hours, and then they just let them go because they knew exactly who they were. They were looking for. They didn't need to arrest anybody else or detain anybody else. And this outraged the community. You know, we see this as inconceivable. We are pretty sure that they wouldn't do it in a Marshall Field. And so why do they think they can do it in a Latino neighborhood in the heart of the Mexican community here in Chicago? So people went out yesterday in numbers to protest this kind of practices.
Angelica Salas rejoins us from Los Angeles as executive director of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights there. In the protests that the police opened fire with rubber bullets on last night, where exactly were you, Angelica? And who were the people that were affected?
Yes, I was actually the main MC of the event, and I started seeing the police rush into the park, and we voluntarily, we started seeing people running. We voluntarily cut our program at 6:30. We had our permit that would go into 9. We cut it. We made sure that we told people to start leaving the park slowly, not to run with their children. I stayed towards the end, and what I saw was that instead of isolating a problem group, they pushed them into the crowd. They started shooting rubber bullets into a crowd of just innocent people. I was caught in the middle of all of this as we were trying to send people out, had to cover a mother with some children. So I am just indignant. I am outraged at the manner in which the police dealt with a family event. We have had millions and millions of people in the streets of Los Angeles. We have worked daily with the police, and for them to actually engage in this kind of action is ludicrous. And I just want to once more say, the majority of the people that were there were assembled in peace. They were demanding their rights. They were demanding an opportunity for legalization, and to have our police act in this manner is completely outrageous. We called a press conference to let our community know that this was not going to be tolerated by the organizers. Immediately we talked to the chief. He was actually there after the event. We talked to him, and we conveyed our just dismay and outrage by what they had done to a group of very innocent people. There were several members of the media who were actually hurt, who were hospitalized, especially, I think, our friends from Telemundo. Overall, I think that it's just a reaction of force that is not necessary when the majority of the people who are marching first of all the organizers are cooperating with you. All the marchers are marching in peace and have done so in the past. But what we also want to just tell the entire Los Angeles community and this country, this is not going to derail us from our mission to pass comprehensive immigration reform, to ensure that immigrant families are together, to ensure that we have no more deaths at the border. This is not going to derail us. We're going to continue fighting, and we're going to make sure that at home in Los Angeles, the police actually treat people as human beings, and that they help us in trying to protect and create a public safety environment versus doing what they did last night.
Angelica, what has the mayor of Los Angeles, Villaraigosa, said, a longtime labor and immigrants' rights activist before he was mayor?
We right away contacted him. He was in El Salvador. We were able to connect with him as well. Right away, he has agreed to investigate what has occurred. We made sure that he too knew members of the media who have been following him in this journey towards Central America and Latin America and Mexico were with him and directly told him what had happened to their crew. So they're in the process of investigating this issue. But again, we're going to be focusing on what the police has done, but we will not be derailed from our pursuit of more humane laws and for the rights of immigrants in this country. That's why we were all marching out there. That's why we were marching in peace.
We're going to go to break, and we'll come back as we talk about the mass rallies across the United States on May Day for immigrant rights. Angelica Salas, Executive Director, Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights in Los Angeles, Jorge Mojica in Chicago. And we'll be joined by two students, one from Los Angeles and one from Detroit. There was also a clash with police in Detroit, and we'll find out more in a minute. We'll be right back. Cazador by Pistolera here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Over the past month, U.S. authorities have arrested and detained at least 750 immigrants in raids across the country. The sweep's part of a program dubbed Operation Return to Sender, run by the federal agency ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, used to be known as INS. We recently interviewed longtime labor journalist David Bacon. He described two of the recent immigration raids in particular.
Supposedly Operation Return to Sender. So ICE has the names of a few people on warrants. So they'll go, for instance, in Richmond, California, they went out to a school and stationed themselves in front of the school, supposedly looking for these people, and just stopped everybody coming in and out. Asked people for their documents, but only, of course, people who look Latino. And in this case, they were stopping women who had just dropped their children off. So obviously, they were going to separate these families if they picked up any of the people who were involved. Or there was just another immigration raid in Chicago where they went to a parking lot in a kind of a mall in the Latino community in Chicago, and began, they just sort of closed off the parking lot, people carrying, you know, assault rifles. They looked like soldiers. And they, again, had the names of supposedly four people that they were looking for. How they expected to find them in a shopping mall in a parking lot, I have no idea. But what they really did was they went and asked everybody for their immigration papers and began just sort of pulling people and shoving them into vans.
Jorge Mojica, was that one of the reasons why people turned out yesterday?
That's correct. I think that this military-like operation, it was totally unjustified. It doesn't have to take place, you know, in any city, any town. Whenever you see a 7-foot-tall person carrying an M16 and ordering you to kneel down on the floor, handcuffing people, we were later on told that the Attorney General of the United States in Illinois gave the order to detain every Mexican male between 14 and 40 years old. That's not a search and look operation. That's an intimidation operation. And people reacted immediately, not only yesterday, but also the same day, the same time of this raid. Hundreds of people gathered outside the shopping mall and started protesting and yelling and screaming against the federal agents that were there.
Students once again played a key role in the May Day protests. In Los Angeles, city officials reported around 600 students walked out of class to join the March for Immigrant Rights. Meanwhile, in Detroit, dozens of students were arrested for taking part in a walkout that also protested the planned closure of dozens of schools. Joining me on the line are two student organizers. Isamar Camacho is a junior at Roosevelt High School in Los Angeles. And joining me from Detroit is Javon Cochran, a junior at Lewis Cass Technical High School in Detroit, an organizer with the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action, Integration, Immigration Rights, and Fight for Equality by Any Means Necessary, known as BAM. Javon, talk about what happened in Detroit yesterday.
Well, yesterday in Detroit, there were student walkouts from several schools against the school closings. Students also walked out against the ban on affirmative action, against, like, the restrictive dress codes and DPS that students get suspended over every day, and also in support of and in solidarity with the movement for immigrant rights. At the schools, at one of the schools, Northern High School, students marched down to the schools who had walked out from several high schools, and we were having like a really peaceful protest. You know, Northern High School in Detroit is one of the schools that's slated to close. And once we got there, you know, the students that had walked out from the other schools wanted the Northern students to come out and, you know, fight to keep their school open, to keep, you know, because if Northern stays open, that's just, you know, Northern is the key school that we need to keep open to fight for the rest of the schools in Detroit. And the students went there and they started chanting, you know, keep Northern open, walk out now. It was a really peaceful protest. But what happened was the security guards and the administration at the school basically just terrorized the students and told them that they were powerless and that they couldn't fight to keep their school open, that they couldn't fight for their city. They blocked all the doors, and they tried to chain the students in, and they called the cops, and, you know, the cops, like, started just attacking the students. The students who had come from the other schools, like Cass, the high school that I go to, and there were, like, we were just standing around peacefully protesting, you know, trying to support the Northern students, and, you know, cops just out of nowhere, totally unprovoked, started macing, like, elementary and middle school students. They grabbed one of the students who had led, like, walkouts at Northern High School almost 2 weeks ago, and they, like, beat him. They beat him. They maced him. They slammed him onto a police car. They arrested him. They arrested students from Osborne High School, which is a high school that over 200 students walked out from yesterday. They grabbed him by his hair, and it was just, you know, several incidents happened, you know, like this yesterday where the police just attacked students and tried to terrorize the students who were fighting for their right to a decent education in our city.
Let's go to Isamar Camacho in Los Angeles, Roosevelt High School. Where did you march yesterday and why?
Well, yesterday we marched from my school, Roosevelt High School, from Boyle Heights through East L.A., and also Hollenbeck High School was with us. And schools from all over L.A. walked out, from Huntington Park High School, from Bravo High School, and Wilson, and other schools, Manual Arts, walked out. And we marched from down to through East L.A. to the march in downtown L.A., to join them and to tell everybody in this nation that we are not accepting second-class treatment any longer. We are not going to accept the INS going into our cities and terrorizing the people who live with us, the people who are in our schools, our friends, our families. We are not accepting it any longer. It's over, and we are going to keep building this movement until our demands are met. And we will fight. We're fighting to win. The students will keep organizing, and we'll be the leadership of this new movement to stop the raids and to make California and every other state in this nation a sanctuary state, a state where the mayors and the governor will not work with the immigration services to terrorize our communities. And the students walked out, and we marched. And we let, you know, the march to fight, and this we are leading this movement to fight for immigrant rights and to fight to make the lives of every person in this nation really better.
Isamar Camacho, your response to Mayor Villaraigosa saying the students should not be walking out, that your parents came to this country to make your lives better, and education is part of that.
Well, my response is that, and the response of many other students is that Villaraigosa, he walked out from his schools. He states it. He says he fought for the rights, for his rights and the rights of, you know, of his community. And now he's telling us, the students, that we cannot fight for our rights to make our lives better, to stop discrimination and not accept the mistreatment that we face every day. That is just hypocritical, and we are not going to accept that kind of statement. We are going to keep fighting until we win, and we will fight until we win.
I wanted to go back to Angelica Salas to ask if you feel that there is a difference in Washington with the Democrats in power.
Well, I think that we were expecting that they were going to come out of the gate. They were going to propose legislation that was going to bring a solution to so many families. Unfortunately, they're just moving very slow and putting forth proposals that are very compromised moving forward. Where our expectation and our call on May Day for a mobilization across the country for immigrant rights is, one, stop these raids. Stop the deportation of these families of innocent people, and they can move on this. They can actually engage our administration. We're also telling the administration that enough is enough, and that their crazy, ludicrous proposals that they're putting forward are not acceptable. We're hopeful that the demands of our immigrants, of our people, are going to be heard. by the elected officials, and that they're going to move quickly on humane, comprehensive immigration reform. And I want to highlight humane. This is not about creating a bracero program. This is not about creating guest workers. This is about giving people opportunities to live in this country legally with an opportunity for citizenship so they have full rights in this country, so that we reduce the backlogs and to ensure that families are together. Right now, a lot of what is at the table is dismantling the family-based visa program that we've had in this country for decades that have allowed so many families to be together, and certainly continuing on this path of what we consider a bracero program, a program that keeps visas in control of employers and never gives workers rights. So that's not what we're fighting for. We're fighting for full rights. So we ask the Democrats to have more courage, to stand up for what is right. They have the right now, at this moment, I wanted to say that probably Representative Luis Gutierrez has stood firmly with us. Yet we need them to stand. We need more of them to stand with us, to have more courage against the administration. And we also believe that it takes two parties to move this forward. We don't want to be talking about this in the 2008 elections. We want them to take action now. Families need relief now. Families need to be together now. And so they need to take their responsibilities to millions of people in this country and really seriously. And we're saying this is a fix, this is a change, not just for immigrants, but for everybody who cares about peace and justice and who cares about the unity of families, who cares about a better tomorrow for America.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Angelica Salas of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights in Los Angeles, Jorge Mojica in Chicago. I also want to thank the two students, Javon Cochran joining us from Detroit, junior at Lewis Cass Technical High School, and as well Isamar Camacho, junior at Roosevelt High School in L.A. As we turn now to look at voices taking on the immigrants' rights movement, from voices behind the immigrants' rights movement to those against them. Our next guest has been closely following the activities of anti-immigrant rights groups in the United States. Max Blumenthal is a Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. His work has appeared in The Nation and Salon, The American Prospect, and The Washington Monthly. Joining us in the Firehouse studio, how are people organizing against immigrants in this country?
Well, there are several components of the anti-immigrant movement in this country, and they're all working very closely together. They have a long-standing program to forcibly remove the 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country, and they're specifically targeting brown-skinned immigrants, people who come from the third world. That's what their target is. So they're actually not a xenophobic movement, they're a nativist movement. I'll get into that in a second. Now, at the top of this movement, you have politicians like Tom Tancredo, Republican representative from Colorado, who's running on the Republican ticket. He's not going to get a lot of votes, but what he's done
running
is
for president.
Running for president. He's effectively shaped the contours of the political debate. His campaign serves as a platform for the anti-immigrant movement, and he has several allies in Congress, like Dana Rohrabacher, the Republican congressman from California, who advanced the far-right rhetoric of the anti-immigrant fringe on the House floor. They've effectively mainstreamed stuff that was considered out of bounds a generation ago. And they've also shaped the way the Democrats treat immigration. Joe Biden, the Democratic senator from Delaware, who's running for president, has endorsed the idea, to my knowledge, he's endorsed the idea of a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. This is an idea that the anti-immigrant movement came up with to keep out what they consider to be the barbarian hordes. It's a patently un-American idea. The ideas of the anti-immigrant movement come from a network of think tanks in Washington and across the country, which were founded and funded by a guy named John Tanton, who is an ophthalmologist from Michigan who came out of the Sierra Club. He believes the greatest danger to civilization is population growth, and he holds immigrants, specifically immigrants from Latin America and Africa, responsible for population growth. This is a guy who's a white nationalist. He's founded organizations like the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which is the largest anti-immigrant think tank, Center for Immigration Studies. You'll see their facts cited in newspapers and in the mainstream press. And in the early 90s, when the anti-immigrant movement was trying to back Prop 187 in California, a ballot measure to restrict services to immigrants there, John Tanton took $1.3 million with the Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR, took $1.3 million from the Pioneer Fund, a group that advanced Nazi propaganda in the 1930s and which exists to fund the science of Hitlerian eugenics. This is a huge scandal. And John Tanton was sort of forced to retreat into the dark. So right now what he's doing is he's deployed several activists to go on TV, to go on sympathetic shows like Lou Dobbs, while he kind of puppeteers the movement. He's funding, sympathetic candidates like Tom Tancredo, but also like left-wing darling and right-wing savior Ralph Nader, who's taken thousands of dollars from John Tanton. Then you have the media. You have people like Lou Dobbs, who works very closely with Tom Tancredo's office, who works closely with these think tanks, and he advances extreme conspiracy theories, like the idea of a North American Union, which came from the far shores of the right, from groups like the John Birch Society. And Lou Dobbs and the Washington Times, another sympathetic outlet, have made an enormous impact, and they've managed to shape the debate as well. You see these ideas advanced in the mainstream press, in newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times. Now, a point I want to make about this movement is that their ideas did not come from a vacuum, and they're not necessarily a rational response to a crisis. They come from the white nationalist movement, a movement that seeks to maintain what they consider the white character of the United States. In 2005, I attended the largest white nationalist conference, the American Renaissance Conference. After passing through an FBI cordon, I met in the lobby with David Duke, the former Ku Klux Klan leader, who, for all his flaws, is a master of PR. And we talked about his days in the late 70s trying to, refine the image of the Ku Klux Klan. And he said, people called me crazy then for what I said about immigration, but I sound like every Republican today and a lot of Democrats, and no one gives me any credit for that. And not only that, I conducted the first civilian border patrol. Indeed, in 1979, David Duke drove around in a car marked Klan Border Watch looking for undocumented immigrants on the border, and he was pursued by about 40 reporters. This was an enormous PR coup for the Ku Klux Klan, and it's been copied by grassroots pressure groups like the Minutemen, who they're adopting a specifically white nationalist strategy from the Ku Klux Klan, and they're working closely with these think tanks, which I just mentioned, the politicians who I just mentioned, and they've moved from the border to towns nearby, like Hempstead. And what they're doing is carrying out protests and vigilante action against day laborers. And this movement is growing more extreme at the grassroots, at the same time more influential in the mainstream.
Max Blumenthal, I read in headlines a story that's gotten very little attention in Alabama. Federal authorities revealing they've broken up a militia plot to attack a group of Mexicans living in the small town north of Birmingham. Last week, six members of the Alabama Free Militia were arrested in a series of raids. The Birmingham News reported police uncovered truckloads of explosives and weapons, including 130 grenades, an improvised rocket launcher, 2,500 rounds of ammunition. The men appeared in court on Tuesday, but despite the violent plot, police did not accuse them of terrorism. Instead, police charged them with conspiracy to make a firearm, which carries a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and $250,000 fine. The Anti-Defamation League says the weapon seizure was the largest in the South in years. Do you know about this group?
I'm really glad you brought that up. I don't know about this group in specific, but I think what we can extrapolate from this story is that the extreme right, militia groups, neo-Nazi groups, groups which who should be considered domestic terrorists, see the anti-immigrant movement as their vehicle. And there's an interesting story I noticed in 2000. The Michigan militia effectively disbanded. This had the largest amount of members during the 1990s, during the heyday of the so-called anti-government militia movement. You know, they organized against Bill Clinton. You know, Waco was their fantasy of black helicopters descending into their communities, taking their guns away. And all of a sudden, they just disappeared. Where did they go? The head of the Michigan militia was interviewed, and he said, "Well, a lot of our guys like what's going on now with the Republicans in power, and we're looking to get into government, and we're looking to support more mainstream causes because they're becoming more influential." So you see an enormous cross-pollination between the membership roles of the anti-government domestic terrorist militias of the 90s and groups like the Minutemen. So that's what's going on here. And I think what we need to look out for as the likelihood of a Democratic majority in government, is very reasonable. You're going to see a more extreme posture from these groups. Just imagine the scenario of Hillary Clinton in power, the perfect boogeyman for the anti-government right. A Democratic Congress, you're going to see them growing more and more extreme. And at the same time,
we've just passed the anniversary of the blowing up of the Oklahoma City building.
Right. And at the same time, you're going to see, more vigilante action against immigrants. And, it's unfortunate that the government is not, treating this as the threat that it is. They're not treating it as domestic terrorism. Obviously, if these characters in Alabama were Arab Muslims, they would be, on their way to some secret prison in Eastern Europe wearing diapers in a Learjet, ready to get waterboarded. But instead, you've got a totally, they're treated totally differently. And their ideas are advanced on shows like Lou Dobbs, which come on during dinner time.
I want to leave it there. Max Blumenthal, thanks for joining us, Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, some of the largest protests against the U.S. military, no, not here in the United States. They take place in Italy against U.S. military bases. Stay with us. Stellara here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. One of the largest protests against the U.S. military this year wasn't where you'd normally expect it. In February, more than 100,000 people marched against a plan to double the size of a U.S. base in the northern Italian city of Vicenza. Over 2,700 U.S. forces are already based there. Critics of the plan say the base will be used as a staging post for the U.S. military to attack Iraq and Afghanistan. Opposition grew so high it helped bring the brief collapse of the government of Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi within days of the protests. The protests against the Vicenza base are known in Italy as No Dal Molino. They've been led mostly by women who've collected thousands of signatures, organized meetings, and raised awareness to turn a local cause into a national movement. This week, a group of these women have traveled from Italy to bring their case to Capitol Hill.
Two of the delegation's members join me from Washington, D.C. Taya Gardelin is one of the founding members of the movement against the Vicenza base. She's here with Stephanie Westbrook. Stephanie's an American citizen living in Rome, a member of the U.S. Citizens for Peace and Justice in Italy. Well, Taya, talk about Vicenza and this base. How did you get involved with this issue?
Well, it started more or less a year ago. As a matter of fact, the Italian government had already been taking position together with the American government concerning this base more than 3 years ago. The population of Vicenza gradually became informed about a year ago. The people who run normal lives, housewives, etc., just decided that it was something that could not be done to Vicenza and to the Vicenza citizens, considering that Vicenza is a historical UNESCO Heritage List site. It is rich in historical buildings by the 1500 architect of Vicenza, Andrea Palladio. And this new military base, it would be a new, the fourth base in the Vicenza area, would distance from the center, the heart of Vicenza, that is the Basilica Palladiana, if I can show you a picture, not even 1 mile from the center of town. This is the historical Basilica Palladiana, where I have my finger over here. And what you see here in the background would be the future Dal Molin military base. As you can see from the picture, it's one of the rare large green areas in the center of town, and the citizens of Vicenza believe that it could be used in a more proficuous way for the people and not for the military.
So the base is there and they want to expand it. What kind of dialogue has there been, Thea, and what kind of protests?
Well, the base is, there is no base here on the picture I showed you yet. There's no base at Dal Molin. Currently there's a civil airport. There's the Camp Ederle base, which also lies in the center of Vicenza. And there's the base of Fontega, not base, it's a military installation of Fontega and the military installation of Longare. And the impact on the people would be extremely strong, first of all, because it's a base that would be, this new base would be approximately 5 kilometers long. That's about almost, I'd say, three miles long. And you can imagine there's all the houses right directly built on, they would be built directly on the borders of the base. You can imagine what it would be for the people living there, directly confining with the base, even though the initial projects presented did not include the housing units of the civilians. I mean, it was just the base. It seemed as if all around there was nothing. There was no city of Vicenza. There was no Palladio villas. There was no people living there. It just seemed that it would be a base in the middle of nowhere. Whereas, as you can see from the picture I just showed you, this does not correspond to truth.
Stephanie Westbrook, you are an American citizen living in Rome. How did you get involved with this issue in Vicenza?
Yes, we have been in contact with them for about the past 6 months. We've participated, both our group in Rome as well as U.S. citizens from Florence, in the two national demonstrations, one in December and one in February, because we felt our voice was something needed. Anytime there's a demonstration against a U.S. military base in Italy, there are accusations of anti-Americanism. So we knew our voice was something important to be there. So we've participated in the demonstrations and have come here to help spread the word in the United States on the impact of this space. In fact, we've got a petition now on the Code Pink website, codepinkalert.org, where people can sign this petition to send a message to the chairs of the Armed Services Committees to stand in solidarity with the Italian people, the people of Vicenza, saying that they don't want this military base and that we want to maintain ties and exchanges with Italy, between the United States and Italy, but we want them to be more on a cultural basis. We don't want them to be strictly on a military basis.
What are your plans, Thea Gardelin, right now coming to the United States? You're not far right now from Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C.
Well, obviously, the movement has taken more and more space, if we can say this, in Italy. From the few people that started it right at the beginning almost a year ago, we've reached practically the entire nation as well as many European countries, because the big demonstration of February 17th brought over 200,000 people to Vicenza. If you consider that Vicenza has approximately 100,000 inhabitants, you can imagine how Vicenza was that day during the demonstration. Our intention here in Washington is to, first of all, invite the American people to be aware of what is happening to Italy, because many people will be asking themselves, why another base in Italy? Why in Vicenza? And this is what we want. We want the American people to be aware of this, and we count on solidarity from the American people. Just like in Italy, we have counted on the energy and on the solidarity of all the people, the women, the elders, the even the entire families who came to the demonstrations to say no to the space. We count on the same thing happening here in the United States. That is, letters of protest, phone calls of protest saying that you do not agree with this decision, that you do not want the base in Italy, that you want the Vicenza UNESCO World Heritage List site to be protected from this project that they have in mind, from this war project that they have in mind. So this is the first reason why we decided to come, why a delegation decided to come to Washington, not only in representation of the entire city of Vicenza, but in representation of those more than 200,000 people that did come to Vicenza to say no to this new project.
Stephanie Westbrook, as an American citizen living in Italy, have you spoken with U.S. soldiers who are deploying from Italy to Iraq or Afghanistan?
I have spoken with a few while I was in Vicenza. For the most part, of course, they're not terribly open about their feelings. They do realize that there's a great deal of opposition by the people of Vicenza, and they also realize that it's nothing against them, the few that I've spoken with. The people in Vicenza they have learned what it means to live with soldiers deploying for war. They see the soldiers out training in the early morning around the streets while they're taking their children to school. So they've learned what it feels like to live with soldiers going off to war.
According to Chalmers Johnson, there are over 700 U.S. bases around the world. I wanted to ask Thea Gardelin, finally, if you were a part of the international organizing in March, the inaugural international conference for the abolition of foreign military bases was held in Ecuador. Are you organizing outside of Italy now?
Well, organizing outside of Italy, we have a lot of contacts with the confining countries in Italy. We have a lot of press contacts outside of Italy. This is one of our first journeys outside of Italy. Obviously, we'll be in Prague at the end of this week. We've been traveling throughout of Italy since a year now, contacting all other movements like ours and organizing something that in Italian is called il patto del mutuo soccorso, which would be more like an agreement of mutual solidarity. That is, that all the peace movements, pacifist movements within Italy unite and help each other constantly, whereas if they have to come to Vicenza, they come to Vicenza. If we have to go to Sigonella, we go to Sigonella. And the same thing we're trying to build throughout Europe and also throughout the entire world.
We're going to have to leave it there, Thea Gardelin. Okay. Thank you for being with us, Italian member of the group Nodal Molin, as well as Stephanie Westbrook. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Hope to Caduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Pressar, Matej Janutz, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Also thanks to Angela Alston, Becca Staley. On Saturday, I will be in Cambridge at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Building 26, Room 100, with Michael Albert, his book Remembering Tomorrow, and Noam Chomsky. That's Saturday. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now!